Hello, it's Derek Arden, and today I'm delighted to be with Peter Thompson. I met Peter 20 years ago when he first brought out The Achiever's Edge, and now called The Achiever's Club, an absolutely fantastic programme of CDs and audios, and I learned so much from it. Peter, we then met as friends, we played golf a lot of times, and then we produced this, 117 Handy Haggling Hints, tips for negotiating, for haggling, and all sorts of things in your life. That was great fun, wasn't it?
Oh, it was so good. And people have often said to me, they said, well, why was it 117? And the reason we put 117 on it was that people would say, why is it 117? And it meant we got into conversation with people about it, which was just another negotiating idea.
And we never really knew, did we? I wasn't even sure there was 117 when we published it, but you never know.
Hang on, I'm just going to check that. I like to make sure that we've got the accuracy going on here. In fact, there was exactly 117.
Now tell me, what was your top tip from there? What was your top haggling hint from 117?
I do have a top tip, and I think it's a top tip in business as well as in life generally. And it's this, is that most people you meet in life are useless at basic arithmetic, let alone mathematics. So that's why we should always negotiate in unusual amounts, because unusual amounts have what's called verisimilitude, and obviously verisimilitude meaning having the appearance of truth, which of course they do have, but must have integrity laden in there, but most people are not good with numbers, so having unusual amounts makes it a lot easier.
Now, I call that funny money. I converted that into funny money, funny numbers, or whatever. So, you know, instead of asking for a 10%, when someone asks you for a 10% discount, don't give them 10%, give them 9.3 or 8.7 or 6.34.
Exactly.
Which is a good number.
I had an occasion once, I was in a shop with one of my many sons, and I was negotiating, as you would, and the guy offered me 10%. And with a bit of a push, I got him to 11%. And after we'd come out of the shop, I said to this particular son of mine, who I won't name, I said, so how much extra discount did we get? And he said, 1%. I said, no, we got 10% extra.
Oh, that's the magic of math.
Because it was the magic of math and the fascination of fractions, because we got 1% extra on 10.
Yeah.
So our discount increased by 10%, just by asking for 1%.
Absolutely.
There we go.
So my tip is, if you don't ask, you don't get. Or, as you reminded me a long time ago, if you don't ask, you don't give the other person the opportunity to say yes.
Correct. If you don't ask, they can't say yes. You can imagine how much fun we're doing this over all the years with Derek, can't you? We've had a blast doing it. And, of course, talking about all of these ideas. And if I was going to add one other tip, it would be this, which is active listening.
Active listening.
Yes, really listening to what people are saying to you, using the rapid repeat technique, which is what you did there, which is repeating in your mind what people are actually saying to you as they're talking along, as long as you don't say it out loud afterwards.
Peter, you don't remember who said this first time, do you? But let me ask you a question. How many animals of each species did Moses take into the ark?
Well, if it only had been Moses, after all, it was Noah really, wasn't it? But that's a bit of active listening.
Did that come from Napoleon Hill?
I just found a listening test online. No, it wasn't online originally. I think somebody had mentioned it to me. I had a list of them. And these days, if you go online, you can find loads of these listening tests. And I love them because they really do make you think carefully. See if I can remember the one. There was one which was, you have two coins which total 30 pence. Since one of those coins is not a 20 pence piece, what are the two coins?
Well, don't ask me. I can't follow that at all.
You can't?
What's the answer?
Well, the answer is a 10 pence and a 20 pence.
Right.
Because I said, since one of those coins is not a 20 pence.
Okay.
I didn't say since, they both weren't.
Okay.
You see, active listening. So Absolutely. Much to learn, isn't there?
Now, one of my favourite stories is Acres of Diamonds.
Oh.
And I heard you tell that.
What
and it's such a story, great story, because everyone goes searching for their goals, and usually it's right under their feet.
Mm.
You remember that story?
Do you want me to tell it?
Please.
Of course. So I heard this originally on Lead the Field, which was by Earl Nightingale, which was the first audio program I ever received. And I got a mailing in from Nightingale Conant, which said I could try it for free. And if I didn't like it, I could send it back, so I'd be stupid not to try it. So I got it in and listened to it a lot. And I ended up actually doing a version for the UK market for Nightingale Conant some years later. And on there, he tells this fantastic story about a guy called Russell Conwell, who was originally a journalist, became a priest, became an educator. And he tells the story about going through Africa and being told about this special story by his guide. And this is how the story goes. There was a farmer called Ali Hafed who lived close by Persia, and he was a very wealthy man. and he had sons and daughters, and he went to bed one night happy and contented. Happy because he was wealthy, and wealthy because he was happy. One day a priest came to see Ali Hafid, and they were just generally talking about life in general, and the priest was telling him how the world was made and how this rolling ball of fog had gone through the universe that God had stirred with his finger. And as the ball of fire cooled down, it started by making rocks, and then it started to make bits of copper, and then it started to make silver, and finally it made gold, and then it made diamonds. Which is actually true, because diamonds are carbon, of course.
Absolutely.
And he said to Ali Hafid, the priest said, he said, if you owned lots of diamonds, a handful of diamonds, you could put your sons and daughters on the thrones of the world. Right? That's how wealthy you would be.
Right.
And he was, that night he went to bed discontented and unhappy and poor. And he was poor because he was discontented and disconnected because he was poor. So what he decided to do was to sell his farm and put his family with some neighbour to look after them while he went in search of diamonds. And so he did, and off he went. Anyway, never heard from him for years and years and years and years. And unfortunately, what did happen to him, he started in the mountains of his moon, made his way through Palestine, and he ended up on the Bay of Barcelona, wretched, totally poor, a terrible state, never found the diamonds, and he walked into the Bay of Barcelona and drowned himself. Meanwhile, back at the ranch or the farm, the man who was owning the farm then was walking across the farm one day with his horse or camel, and he saw something glittering in a very shallow stream on clear sand, very pale sand. And he bent down, picked it up, thought it was a nice looking piece of stuff, and he put it on the mantelpiece. A few weeks later, the original priest who told Ali Hafid about diamonds came in and to see the man, and he saw this lump of stone on the mantelpiece, and he went, "Oh, Ali Hafid's come back." And the guy said, "No, we've never heard of him." He said, "But the diamond." And he said, "No, it's not a diamond, it's a piece of, you know, quartz I picked up in the stream." He said, No. He said, "That's a big..." Anyway, they got it down, they had it assessed, and sure enough, it was a diamond. And what happened was, and we know the moral of the story, don't we, was the fact that Ali Hafid had sold his farm, which in fact was acres of diamonds, and the reason was he'd never found out that diamonds were often found in shallow, clear water running on pale sand. And he owned acres of diamonds, as you and I do as well, Derek and I do. And he'd gone off to search for them somewhere else, which was such a shame, because everybody is living in their own acres of diamonds. It's only a matter of picking them up where we stand. It's the old expression, isn't it? The grass isn't greener on the other side, it's greener where it's watered, which I think is the same message as the acres of diamonds. I love the story. And by telling that story over 6,000 times, Russell Conwell raised the money to build Temple University in America, which was for students who couldn't afford to go to other universities. And that has since become the most amazing institution. So a great story, great man, great idea.
It's a brilliant story, and we can take so many things from that if we think about it. Number one, we've got to do our preparation and our research. Number two, look around you and keep your eyes open on what's going on. And number three, do your research. Peter, that's brilliant. Now, business people make all sorts of mistakes, and you've worked with so many different businesses. Yeah, sometimes we think how stupid we were 3 months ago, don't we?
Yeah,
but that's the beauty of learning.
It's the old Mark Twain quote, isn't it? When I was 14, I thought my father was an idiot. And when I became 21, I couldn't understand how he'd learned so much in 7 years.
Those things are amazing. What's the top three mistakes that business people make now?
Okay. I think number one is when it comes to being commercial. And you know my expression, Derek, and you may not have heard it from me, but it's this. Is money is the silent applause for a job well done and value delivered to others. And I think if we think of money in that way, it doesn't become our focus. It becomes an oblique goal. Our real goal is something else, and that is a reward for doing something. But let's talk about money as we're talking on the Negotiation Podcast. And I think the first thing is that people don't test often enough on their pricing.
Right.
So they leave the same pricing in play for a long, long time. So that's mistake number one. It's always worth testing to see what the market is prepared to pay, because there is this inherent link between price and value. And sometimes we can underprice and we can reduce our number of clients or customers, depending which way you think of it, another conversation for another day, by having a price that's too low rather than a price that's too high, number one. Number two is not having a deluxe version of what it is that you offer. So for example, if you went to a hotel, you would expect them to have executive rooms and suites and standard rooms. If you went to buy a car, you would expect it to have different levels of the model that you were buying. If you went to fly across the Atlantic, you would expect that there would be tourist class, there would be club, there would be first class. And everything that you buy, if you look around carefully, you'll find there are deluxe versions of them. Why is that? Wouldn't we all drive the same car, sleep in the same bed, fly on the same planes? No, it doesn't work that way. People want choice in the marketplace. And therefore, if you don't have a deluxe version of what you're offering, and I've been offering deluxe versions for 45 years in business, then we are leaving an absolute fortune on the table, number one. And number two, we are not delivering the depth of value that some of our clients actually want from us. So I think that's really important indeed.
Question there, yep. It's three options you give people, isn't it? It's always three. It's
three options.
And the one you really want to sell is in the middle?
Depends. One of the ideas is that you make the price of the top one and the differential between the middle one smaller than the price of the middle one to the bottom one. So if the bottom one is £100, the next one is £200, the middle one, then the top one would be £250, not £300. The gap is smaller between the middle and the top than it is between the middle and the bottom.
And do you know what the thinking is on
Yes,
that?
It is. But because the difference is so small to move up to the royal top one, then more people are likely to do so.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And the third idea is that I believe there is a misconception in the marketplace, and this has certainly been my experience over the 45 odd years I've been in business, is that people tend to think a lot of people are price sensitive, and I don't think they are. I think they're value sensitive. And I'm amazed how many people try and buy their place in the marketplace when really if they concentrated on value and delivered the right value for the right price. I've found in life maybe 10% of people are buying on price and the other 90% of people are buying on value and relationships. And so I think that's just so true. So I think it's a mistake to concentrate on low pricing when really you should concentrate on high value.
But people are scared, aren't they? There's that initial scared feeling about losing business if I don't agree to what they're asking for.
Well, the challenge is that if you do agree to what they're asking for, then what's happening is that you're ending up with a transactional customer instead of a relational client. And the way I am in business is I only deal with relational clients. I'm not interested in transactional customers. And the beauty is, and I was taught this by a man called Roy H. Williams, The Wizard of Ads in the States, very clever guy, beautiful books, by the way, Roy H. Williams, The Wizard of Ads. And Roy explained to me when I interviewed him, he said, Peter, the difference is this. With the relational client, they look to you to be the expert. And therefore, they're prepared to pay expert prices and treat you as the expert. Whereas the transactional customer is their own expert, has done all the research, has gone around and then deals with three suppliers and beats them all up to get the lowest possible price. And the only way you'd ever upset them is when they bought, tell them they could have had it a pound cheaper somewhere else because they don't like that. They're only buying on price, but they're in the minority. Yes, it's context driven, but nevertheless, I like to deal with relational clients who are happy to treat me as the expert. You wouldn't go to the doctor because you've got a problem with your toe and it was going to be cut off. And the surgeon would say to you, I'll tell you what, I've got a special on today. If we cut the second toe off, you can have it for half price. That is not going to happen, is it? Because you treat them. It's relational. It's absolutely relational. So it's deciding where we want to be in the marketplace. Do we want to be relational clients and attract them? Therefore, we've got to be the expert. Walk like the expert, talk like the expert, have products like the expert, have books, tips, booklets, our website looks expert. Or do you want to deal with the transactional customer who wants to treat you as a commodity, as though you're a jar of jam? Not for me, thank you very much.
And clearly the first thing you've got to do on all these things is make sure your first impression is absolutely fantastic, because the research says you've got about 4 seconds to make a first impression. Peter, that's been absolutely fantastic to see you again.
Lovely to see you.
I hope
too.
We're going to make another one of these at some stage, because it's great fun. One last tip for people for next year.
Right. I would say this. I would say whatever goals you've set for yourself, go forward in your mind to the point when you could or should have achieved them, depending which word you prefer to use. And imagine for a moment that you haven't. And ask yourself this question. If only I'd ... I would have achieved those goals. What are the dots? You'll be amazed what your mind will tell you.
Peter, I was hoping to catch you out with one of those questions. Yet again, it was impossible to catch. Peter Thompson, thank you very much
My
for
pleasure
joining
day.
Me. Thank you very much indeed for watching this. I look forward to seeing you on the next one.